Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed.
He's come a long way from the playgrounds of Gary, Indiana in the 1950s, and he's still moving forward. He began his basketball career by tossing a ping pong ball at a soup can. And it wasn't until his junior year at Roosevelt High School that he joined a school team. But in the senior season, he helped Roosevelt to the final game of the state tournament in 1955, where it lost to Oscar Robertson and Chris Posadix. He wasn't able to land a major college scholarship because he hadn't taken his academics seriously enough. So he went to an NAIA school, Tennessee A&I, later to become known as Tennessee State, and led it to three consecutive national championships. He was the fourth pick in the 1959 NBA draft, excluding two territorial picks, but later took a detour through the ABL, where he led Cleveland to the league championship. The trade from the Lakers to the Knicks set him up to win two NBA championship rings, and all in all, he played part of 15 professional seasons, was named to one All-Star team, and averaged nearly 16 points for his career, with one of the most unique jump shots the game has ever seen. But he didn't stop there. After entering the NBA without a degree, he went back to school before he retired to get one. And then he got a graduate degree. And then a doctorate. Let's get to this. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Dr. Dick Barnett.
This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions. They make your memories last forever. And Robin Run Village, Central Indiana's finest continuing care retirement community.
All right, today's one-on-one episode comes to you over the phone lines all the way to El Cerrito, California. We're going to talk with a man I've been wanting to meet for a long time, and we're not exactly meeting right now, but we are talking on the phone. Dr. Dick Barnett grew up in Gary, Indiana, played for the World Championship Knicks, has quite a story to tell. We're going to jump right into it. Dr. Barnett, you were born in 1936 in Gary, Indiana. Tell me what your dad did there while you were growing up.
Well, Mark, he was a what most black people that were in Gary at that point. If you were not a school teacher or a professional, you worked in the steel mills of Gary.
Yeah,
and that was what he did.
Had your dad been an athlete? I mean, I know, you know, in the 1930s or 20s or whatever, when he was growing up, there probably weren't a lot of opportunities. But had he been athletic?
No, that was no pedigree in my family of anybody being involved in athletics at all.
How then?
I had a brother and one brother and one sister.
You have an older brother?
Yes, an older brother.
Okay. Was he an athlete?
No, he wasn't.
Okay, so how?
He was a lover. He wasn't an athlete.
He was a lover?
Of course.
Okay. How did you get started then, and how did you get started playing basketball?
Oh, just by happenstance. It was something that I observed others doing, and I wanted to participate in. And also, I was looking down the road for a future beyond the steel mills of Gary, Indiana.
I was going to say,
I thought this might be a possible exit from that future.
Yeah, you saw what your dad was going through, and you didn't want to work in the steel mills, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So where did you start playing basketball? Where did you develop your game?
Well, I was playing on the playground, just playing intermittently, I guess anybody that would play on the concrete areas of Gary, Indiana. Roosevelt High School, in the alleyways, wherever a basket could be found and a ball could be had. And that's where the competition started and progressed.
Yeah. Was there a particular place that you remember most fondly as far as where you developed your game, a certain playground or park or something like that?
Well, it was probably on the playground at Roosevelt High School. That's where I went to to the high school, and they had a playground, and I spent most of my time on the playground at Roosevelt High School.
Were you good right away? I mean, did the game come to you naturally?
Well, it wasn't naturally, but I started. Let me give you a prerequisite of how all of this started. I really, before I got to the playgrounds of Roosevelt High School, I started at the Friendship House, which was a community center where young kids would go to play, communicate, gather, and just socialize. And I was at the Friendship House, and I started playing with a ping pong ball and a tin cup on a wall.
Oh, there you go. And a ping pong ball and a tin cup.
And I became very proficient at that. So, in fact, I became so proficient at that the coaches at Roosevelt High School said, if you can put this ping pong ball in this cup on a wall, then let's see what you can do with a basketball, and everything emanated from there.
How big was that tin cup on the wall?
Just a tin cup, you know, a Campbell's soup cup.
And you're throwing a ping pong ball in there.
A ping pong ball from all type of distances, and experimenting as a young teenager and just having fun.
And you're left-handed, right? Left-handed tosses.
Right.
How old were you then when you played on your first organized basketball team?
Well, once I became more proficient, probably about 14, 15.
Like on a freshman team in high school or something like that?
Well, I didn't really play. I only played 2 years in high school.
2 years? Okay. Wow.
2 years, my junior year and my senior year in high school. Freshman and sophomore, I was playing on the playground.
Wow. Did you just not want to go out for teams before then, or did you not feel you were good enough? Or
no, it wasn't that I wasn't good enough. I came from a very poor circumstances. We were just trying to survive, and I had other issues in my life rather than going out for the team. And finally, I was so good on the outside courts that the coaches kind of drafted me to join the Roosevelt High School team.
Did you have to work to help support the family, or can you talk about some of those issues at home?
Well, you did what you can. I didn't have an organized job selling papers and, those type of jobs just to survive under those circumstances. And finally, the coaches convinced my parents and myself that I should come out for the team, and that's what happened. And very successful my 2 years in high school.
Absolutely. I'm curious. By then you were a good player when you go out for the team as a high school junior. Did you have any embarrassing moments, though? Like, things you weren't familiar with yet? Or I always ask people if they had any embarrassing moments in their sport when they were young and beginning to play. Anything happen to you?
Not particularly. Not really. I was pretty my game was very well developed at that stage. I played against you're probably familiar with Fred Williamson, that played with Northwestern and went on to play professional football. And
the Hammer?
Yeah, in the movies, exactly.
Yeah, I didn't know he was from Gary. I didn't realize he was from Gary.
Yeah, he's from Gary. We played against each other in high school in basketball. And also Alex Karras, that just died about a year ago.
Right.
He played with the Detroit Lions. He was a basketball player also.
Was he a good basketball player?
In high school. He was pretty good.
Well, so your junior year, Gary Roosevelt, and then your senior year, you guys go to the state championship game where you lose to Attucks.
Yeah, we were the first two black teams in Indiana basketball history to play for the state championship. And obviously with Oscar and Oscar Robertson, the great player. They beat us by a wide margin for the state championship. They had a great team, and, you know, it was a great experience.
Yeah, they won that championship game 97-74. How was it received back in Gary? Must have been huge back there, though, for you guys to get to the final game.
No, you know, it was great. The city was excited, and, you know, that had never been achieved before, and it was a new adventure for everybody, and we were pleased. And, you know, the only thing I look back on it, obviously, I'm much older now, and I couldn't, you know, I was like most particularly young black youngsters. I was seduced and intoxicated by sports. I didn't understand that academics and education could peacefully and productively coexist, and I really wasn't interested in education at that point. I was just trying to do enough just to get by. I couldn't look down the road 30 or 40 years and see how education was going to impact my life and change my perspective and do all the things it has done for my future. And obviously that occurred through maturing and psychologically and emotionally.
Barnett doesn't make the Indiana All-Star team and doesn't get a scholarship offer from a major state college. So he heads off to Tennessee A&I, which works out great for him when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, I'm Mark Monteith, spending an hour with Gary's own Dr. Dick Barnett. He got a late start on his high school career and wasn't serious about his studies either. That meant his best option was to attend an NAIA school, and that led to championships. I'm curious, when you're growing up and playing on the playgrounds, you know, there weren't NBA games on television then and probably not even college games. I mean, did you have players or teams that you kind of looked up to or tried to emulate, that type of thing? Or was there?
Well, I was influenced to a great extent by the icons of that era. Joe Louis, when he would win his championships and everybody was out on the street celebrating, and we were influenced, obviously, from 1947 when Jackie Robinson broke in with the Brooklyn Dodgers. So we were influenced by those racial issues that emanated in America at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was influenced to a great extent by those circumstances.
And so it really was people outside of basketball that motivated you and influenced you.
No question about it. Not only outside of basketball, but Thurgood Marshall of the Supreme Court. Those type of examples, and getting into the civil rights movement, obviously with Rosa Parks and Martin Luther King and the whole movement really motivated young people not just to concentrate on sports, but understand, you know, who you were and what America was all about.
You were motivated to make something of yourself just by the example those people set, one way or the other.
No question about that. No question about that.
Did you participate in other sports besides basketball in high school?
No, the only sport that I participated in besides basketball was cross country, and that was to get in shape to play basketball.
Yeah, and that's no fun at all, was it?
Well, you know, I wanted to be in shape. Fortunately, and I talk to young people about this all the time, I never got into drugs. I never smoked. I took care of my body. I was always in shape, and that's one of the average career of an NBA player is 3.5 years or less. I played 15 years.
Yeah.
So you had to be in excellent shape. And I understood that taking care of my body was the engine and one of the secrets of my success.
Yeah.
So I was always in shape.
Now, you were very consistent in those state finals games. You scored 18 points in the afternoon game. when you guys beat Fort Wayne North and you scored 18 in the final game when you lost to Attucks. So you were a consistent player, I take it. And I'm curious about, you did not make the Indiana All-Star team for that annual series with Kentucky, which is kind of amazing looking back on it, that an NBA veteran like yourself, you were an NBA All-Star one year, you know, did not make that game for the Indiana-Kentucky series. Now, your teammate at Roosevelt, Willie Eisen, was Mr. Basketball in 55. He went to Purdue.
Wilson Eisen, yes.
Yeah. Did he? Did the fact that maybe he made the team hurt your chances? Did they not want to take two from one team or something? I mean, I'm just
that might have been the case, but I don't know. He played all 4 years at Roosevelt.
Yeah, you were a latecomer,
and I only played 2 years, so that might have been a factor. But he wasn't drafted, and he didn't play in the NBA.
Right. No, yeah. You wouldn't trade your career for his, I'm sure. Tell me about the recruiting process, though. Were you contacted, or did you have any chance to go to a Big Ten school or another college in Indiana?
I get back to that educational thing again. My grades were such that, and also my coach, that was a network of the black coaches in historical black colleges, and my coach was a good friend. My high school coach was a good friend of John McLennan, who was a coach at Tennessee State.
Right.
So they worked out an arrangement. And I wasn't even thinking about a scholarship and going to Tennessee State, and it just happened. There were choices probably going to Indiana University and other schools because of my talent, but probably my grades would have forestalled that happenstance.
Okay, but you wind up at Tennessee State. It was called Tennessee A&I at the time, I believe.
It was Tennessee A&I, Agricultural and Industrial College.
Okay. They won three national NAIA titles. You were the most valuable player in the tournament in 1958 and 59. You are still the school's all-time leading scorer, more than 3,000 points. Memories from that college career, you know, did you start to take academics seriously then, or...
Let me give you a bird's-eye view of my maturation. I struggled again. I was obviously an outstanding player at Tennessee State and left Tennessee State without a degree. I played 4 years at Tennessee State and did not get a degree, and what changed my perspective in terms of education? Matter of fact, it was my fifth or sixth year in the NBA. I had a very career-threatening injury. I snapped my Achilles tendon. And as I was lying on the operating table, and the doctor said, "You might not play any more professional basketball." And I was lying there, obviously without a college degree, without a focus on the future, and didn't understand what I would be able to do if I was no longer able to play professional basketball. And at that time, I determined that I better begin that process over and go back to school and finish that process. And that's what transpired.
Yeah. So when you were in college, you were probably just doing enough to get by, right?
Just enough to get by, and really wasn't very taking it very seriously.
You were the fourth pick in the NBA draft, however, in 1959 by the Syracuse Nationals. Now, obviously, in 1959, there's no televised draft. I'm curious how you found out that you had been drafted by the Syracuse Nationals.
Well, I got a phone call. I got a phone call, and the thing about it, I wasn't really concentrating on, you know, it was a surprise phone call, and I was happy that I was, the four or whatever, because I thought I was one of the better players in the country. There was no doubt in my mind about that. You know, so it was something that, you know, I felt I wanted to compete against the best, and obviously, as I understand, there was only about eight or nine teams in the NBA at that particular time.
Right.
If you were drafted that high with all the millions of young men playing basketball, then you must be good.
Do you remember your rookie salary with the Nationals?
$8,000.
Well, that was good then.
Yeah.
You know, for that time.
A lot of money in those days.
Yeah, and it must have seemed like all the money in the world to you coming out of the environment you came from.
No question about it. I'm getting paid now for doing something that I was just doing and having fun.
Barnett joins George Steinbrenner in the ABL, wins a championship, and returns to the NBA when One-on-One continues. We're back on One-on-One. Mark Monteith here with Gary native Dick Barnett. He jumped from the NBA to the ABL for a season and won a championship. But he returned to the NBA to play for the Lakers and the Knicks. And he became an All-Star. Now, you jumped to the American Basketball League in 1961. I'm curious about that.
George Steinbrenner.
Yes, George Steinbrenner owned a team in Cleveland, the Cleveland Pipers. Now, people in Indianapolis, of course, know all about the ABA. A lot of people don't know about the ABL, a league that lasted, about a year and a half in the early 60s. Teams in Hawaii, Kansas City, Chicago, and you were on the team in Cleveland. I'm taking it you jumped because you got a better contract offer from Cleveland, or?
Well, I wasn't happy with my circumstance in Syracuse. I wanted to get a chance to play more. And also, the money was a little bit better, but my college coach went to Cleveland.
Yeah, John McLendon was the first black professional coach.
Yeah, he went
in
to
any
Cleveland,
sport.
And Steinbrenner was a good salesman. In fact, he was petitioning Cleveland at that time to try to get into the NBA.
Right. Did you get to know Steinbrenner very well?
Yeah, I knew George very well.
You liked him okay?
He was a P.T. Barnum. He was a promoter. He did the same thing with the Yankees, and when he was with the Yankees, we stayed in contact over the years until he died.
Good. Well, there got to be some stories from the ABL. The ABL was even more ragged than the ABA was in those early years, from what I'm told. I mean, what sticks out in your mind? You guys won a championship.
We won the ABL championship the first year.
Right. I read somewhere that Steinbrenner sold one of your teammates at halftime of a game in Hawaii. Is that true?
Well, the only story I have had about George, I don't know if I'm trying to recall the names from so long ago. One of the players walked in and he was unhappy with his contract, and he yelled at George that he was going to sue him. And George said, "Well, why don't you get in line?" You know.
Yeah, yeah. There was one thing I read that you had a player named Grady McCollum who was sold at halftime of a game in Hawaii and sent over to the other locker room.
That might have been true. There were a number of things that were transpiring in that league at that particular time.
Yeah, yeah. Well, some of the players, you know, Connie Hawkins, who went on to make it in the ABA, played in the ABL. Larry Staverman, the first coach of the Pacers, played in the ABL. Larry Siegfried, who played for the Celtics. Sweetwater Clifton, who had been a famous Globetrotter, was in the ABL. There were some players there. How did you guys draw in Cleveland? What kind of attendance did you get?
Yeah, you had about a couple of thousand people a game. Uh-huh. A couple of thousand people a game.
One of your teammates was John Barnhill, who went on to play for the Pacers for a couple of years.
Right, and John was a assistant. He played with the Lakers, and that team at Tennessee State, 7-8 players at that time went on to play in the NBA.
You averaged 26.2 points for the Cleveland team. You were first team all ABL, and you won the championship, as you said. So I'm guessing that year had to be pretty satisfying for you.
Athletically, it was. It was satisfying, and got a chance to play and reestablish my game, that type of thing, before the court case started again. getting back to the NBA.
Yeah. How much of a raise did you get to go to Cleveland? What were you earning there?
Probably about $5,000-$6,000, whatever it was.
Well, I mean, you're making $8,000, you said, in Syracuse, right? So surely you got more to go to Cleveland, didn't you? Or did you get
probably about $4,000 or $5,000 more?
Okay, but mainly for you, it was about just getting a chance to play, right?
Yeah, I really wanted to get a chance to play more, exactly.
But yeah, you mentioned the court case before that second season of the ABL. You had to go back to Syracuse, right? I mean, I know you were eventually sold to the Lakers, but you were not allowed to play that second year in the ABL?
That's right. Before that case was decided, that trade happened. And in fact, the court upheld the reserve clause. So I wasn't going to be able to leave anyway.
Okay, so you're still property. They ruled you were still property of the Syracuse franchise?
That's correct.
Okay. But then you go to L.A. They sell you to L.A. Now, I would think in the early 60s, that would have been a pretty nice environment to be in L.A. Did you enjoy it out there?
No, it was a new environment. And I was playing with Elgin Bell and Jerry West, great players. And had a very excellent team. And you know, the franchise did well out there.
You're a long way from Gary, Indiana, when you're playing for the Lakers in L.A. Then
way from Gary, Indiana.
Were you enjoying, you know, living out there and the lifestyle and everything? I mean,
you get a little taste of Hollywood and Wilshire and Hollywood and Vine and you know the whole palm trees and the different social environment. So it was radically different than Midwest Gary, Indiana.
Absolutely. I would think that would be fun and also maybe even a distraction, you know, when you got all that going on out there. You played well for the Lakers, obviously, but I would think that there'd be a lot of things out there that could turn a kid's head from Indiana.
Well, I was pretty focused. Well, one of the things that I don't know if that's in your records, but I had a club out in Los Angeles, Dick Barnett's Guys and Dolls.
I did not know that. Okay. Dick Barnett's Guys and Dolls.
That was in the heyday of Motown. And we had all the, you know, we had everybody there. You know, Temptation, Aretha Franklin.
Four Tops.
Four Tops.
So the club did well, I bet, for a while, huh?
They did well, you know, after 3 years, once I was traded, I had to let it go because, you know, you couldn't keep up with it. But
yeah,
it was obviously a tremendous situation. Exactly.
You're young, living in L.A., playing for the Lakers and owning a club. That sounds like you had it going then. That sounds like it was a good time for you.
No, it's a long way from the playgrounds of Gary, Indiana.
Absolutely. Your parents probably couldn't believe it.
And the steel mills of Gary, Indiana.
Yeah, it doesn't smell out there. And at this time, this is before probably that, you know, L.A. had all the smog issues and stuff. I would think the early 60s were a great time to be in L.A.
Well, they had smog out there during that particular time. And also, you got to remember, I was out there during the Watch riots.
Yeah.
A number of things were transpiring in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah. What was it like playing with Elgin Baylor and Jerry West?
No, it was great playing with them. But, you know, I might have overestimated my own talent. I thought I was just as good as Jerry or Elgin.
Uh-huh.
If given the time. But, you know, that's the way sometimes the ball bounces and, you know, your career is impacted by the kind of time that you spent on the court.
You had one of the most unique jump shots in the history of the NBA. You know, you kind of kicked your legs. Chick Hearn dubbed it, you know, fall back baby, your shot. How did that develop?
Mark, just by happenstance.
Yeah.
My shot transpired for balance, distance, coordination, and being comfortable. And I perfected it by repetition, and it just became second nature. But that was the reason while that transpired.
Yeah, Fall Back Baby. It's really a kind of a famous people, longtime NBA fans will know what that means and who it refers to. Did you spend a lot of time as a kid on the playground shooting by yourself, or was it mostly just playing in games?
You know, thousands and thousands of hours by myself. Thousands and thousands of hours.
And when you're doing that, are you daydreaming of playing professional basketball?
Oh, yeah, well,
at that time, you know, again, there weren't NBA games on television, and so I don't know how even – I don't know if you were even familiar with the pros at that time of the, say, the early 50s. There certainly were great players then, but I didn't know if you would be daydreaming of playing against so-and-so or playing for –
Well, you would see people occasionally, but that was about it. But, you know, you had some tremendous players on the playgrounds in Gary and in Chicago. You know, they had the Sweet 16 on television, and you could see players play. So, you know, you had examples of people, and you could see the NBA Finals at some point or whatever. So yeah. You got a chance to see players.
You were traded from L.A. to the Knicks for Bob Boozer right before the 1965-66 season. It turned out great for you because, as we said, you played on two championship teams for the Knicks. But at the time of that trade, were you happy about it, or were you disappointed to be leaving L.A.?
No, I was happy about it because I wanted to get – obviously, I wanted to get a chance to play.
You're kind of in the shadow.
I was playing and have – you know, I wanted to start – and display my talent. As I indicated, I thought I was one of the best players in the league over that period of time. And, you know, as I indicated, I played in one All-Star game. And if you look at my record, I think I should have played in five or six All-Star games.
Barnett wins a couple of NBA championships with the Knicks and then goes on to star in the academic world when One-on-One continues. But first, here he is, hitting a shot over Wilt Chamberlain in that legendary seventh game of the 1970 championship series.
As we indicated, Barnett is back in, giving Frazier his first rest. There he is, number 12. Chamberlain comes out to guard Barnett on a switch. And the hook shot. Tennessee State star.
And there's another benefit of having Reed in that lineup. You saw that set he picked on, put on Barnett, and Wilt Chamberlain had to switch. That was not occurring on Wednesday evening.
Welcome back to One on One. Mark Monteith here to bring you the story of Gary native Dick Barnett. He started on that Knicks team that won the championship in 1970, but by then he realized he was going to need something to fall back on after retirement. So he went back to school and kept going back. And you're a starter on that really famous, legendary Knicks team in 1970 that was so famous for teamwork. You know, you're playing with Walt Frazier and Willis.
Bradley, Busher, and Reed.
Yeah, yeah. Phil Jackson's a backup on that team. Tell us about playing on that team, what it was like for you. You were, as we said, you were kind of a forgotten guy on that team, but you know, you were a great scorer. You know, what was it like for you being a member of that team?
No, it was very satisfying. You know, Red Holzman was a great coach, and everybody understood their role and how everybody shared the ball and did those type of things. So we had a very coordinated team that not only on offense but defense and the whole strategy and game plan of how we became world champions at that time worked out very well.
Yeah, so the teamwork and the camaraderie of that group was every bit as good as we were led to believe it was? You know, that it was...
Yeah, when you say the camaraderie, particularly on the court, you know, once people left the court, people went their own separate ways, but we understood what we had to do coordinating on the basketball court, and the intelligence of players of how they could work together and take advantage of the other team, I think it was very high.
Yeah, and when you're a member of a championship team in New York, that's got to be good. I mean, you're riding high if you're in New York City on a championship team, right? You must have fond memories.
You're still riding high. They haven't had a championship team since the last two championship teams that I was on.
Right. Yeah, they're still waiting for another.
Still waiting on another one.
Absolutely. Yeah, you were on again the teams in 70, 73. You were a starter in 70. I saw a classic clip of Howard Cosell interviewing you in the locker room after that championship in 1970. You could tell, like, hey, there's a guy who is living life right there.
You were remarkable, you son of a gun, with those driving left hands. Just remarkable in getting the arch over a Wilt's head.
Well, I've been pretty successful during the series doing this. I see dollar signs up there on the backboard.
Do you recall just the feeling you got from winning that championship in 1970, what that meant to you?
It was a great feeling, but, you know, one of the things that sports is so transitional, Mark, that, you know, it's here today and gone tomorrow. One of the things that I appreciated of my athletic career, the championships in college, the three championships at Tennessee State, the championships in the ABL, even though that leg didn't last long, and the two championships in the NBA, all of them are great memories, but my greatest championship is being able to last in a league where the average career of an NBA player is 3.5 years or less, and I played 15 years.
Yeah.
That's the highlight of my career, that I must have been doing something right, and that's an indication of the dedication, the commitment, the concentration, and the conviction to live your dream. And that's what I tell young people.
And you started going to college, though. You started going back to school to earn your college degree while you were still playing for the Knicks, right?
That's exactly what happened. I started going back in the offseason, and I got going back to Los Angeles that first year. I finished Cal Poly Pomona and received my bachelor's degree in physical education. And when I was with the Knicks, I was still going to school. I enrolled at New York University and received my master's in public administration. And my last year, I finally enrolled in Fordham University and received my doctorate in education. So, you know, it was a long run, and I really finally realized that education is about options, opportunities, and possibilities, and you have to get ready for the future.
And your desire to get those degrees, does it all trace back to that injury you had and when you feared your NBA career might be over?
Well, that was one of the major incentives at that point. That I knew that I'd better get ready, because a number of people have fun playing the game and really have problems how they lead the game. So I was trying to get ready to disengage psychologically and emotionally. When I got ready to leave the game, it would be a smooth transition.
Yeah, and then, of course, you were on that Knicks team where you had the famous Willis Reed game when he comes out of the tunnel and you guys are playing the Lakers and that type of thing. What do you remember from that game?
I wasn't surprised that Willis would come out. Even, you know, he was limping and, you know, he wasn't 100%, but whatever he was, I knew he was going to participate, and I wasn't surprised. And I think with the force of the crowd and everything else that surrounded that game, I think that helped propel us to win that first championship.
Yeah, I was going to say, was it inspiring to you guys to have him come out like that, and just the way the crowd responded and everything?
Well, no question about that. We knew we were not going to be able to get too much from him offensively, but he played a great defense on Will, just trying to keep him away from the basket, and we were off and running.
Yeah,
exactly.
I got to be honest with you. I was a Laker fan at that time, and as I watched that game as a young kid, I thought, why are they not getting the ball to Chamberlain every time down the court? I mean, he could have dominated, and they didn't even throw him the ball.
Well, I don't know about that. Well, 50 years later.
I know. Still bothers me, though. But anyway, okay. It was a great for you guys. And that's, you know, one of the most famous moments in NBA history of just him coming out of that tunnel and the way you guys dominated the game. Walt Frazier had a great game, and you all played so well. Do you stay in touch with your Knick teammates often?
No, we stay in contact, particularly with technology, with the internet, and where technology has gone. In fact, we're having later on this month, it's going to be a reunion at Madison Square Garden of one of our Knicks championship teams.
Yeah, you're right. This is the 40th anniversary, isn't it, of your 73 championship team? As we said, you got your doctorate at Fordham in education. So what have you done since then, and what are you doing now?
Since then, I've been a professor at St. John's in sport management for 4 years. I taught at St. John's University. Since then, I've left and started the center. I've started SportsScope, the Center for the Study and Research of Athletes and Sports in American Society.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the president of that, and that's what I'm doing now. And one of the things before, and you can put this, when you edit this, Mark, one of the things that has happened, I've written 14 books over the period since I've left. I've got 3 books coming out this year. And one of my books that I've written is getting ready to be made into a movie, okay?
Which book is that?
The book is called The Athlete Negro, and Spike Lee is going to be the director.
The Athlete Negro?
The first book is called The Awakening. The Athlete Negro, The Awakening. Black athletes finally putting their resources together. The billions of dollars that are being made today, and where there are no job academies or employment industries whatsoever, they're finally putting their resources together, and people are trying to stop them to retain that power that they maintain today. So you'll be hearing about The Athlete Negro, the new film that's going to be coming out.
Okay. When does that come out? Do you know?
No, we're in the embryonic stages. We just put together a executive producer, and you know, we're talking about raising between $20 to $25 million for this film to be made. So, you know, we're about a year away.
Now, is it like a movie or a documentary?
Oh, this is going to be a movie.
If somebody had told you in high school that you'd be doing all these things and the way your life would transpire, could you have believed it?
No. It's if you believe in yourself, you know, I'm a very spiritual person. I believe in a God unseen, a voice unheard, a touch unfelt. All these things that have guided my journey and my dream. And, you know, I talk to young people, and I do a tremendous amount of lecturing across the country and colleges, and my concentration is on 5 things, Mark. Consciousness, commitment, conviction, courage, and control. And you have to have those things to follow a dream. And my dream and I felt, you know, very adamantly that spending all those times on the playgrounds of Gary, that my dream and I, we had a rendezvous with destiny. And that's what transpired over the years.
One-on-One with Dick Barnett continues in a moment. But first, here he is, hitting his legendary jump shot in Game 7 of the Finals in 1970.
To Buescher. To Frazier. Barnett. kicking jump shot of Barnett. 10 points for Barnett.
All right, thanks to Dick Barnett for donating to the one-on-one cause. You know, I'll bet anyone who watched him play back in the day would be surprised to learn he's got a doctorate and is doing so many things outside of basketball. He's written books and poems, does a lot of public speaking, and runs the SportsScope Foundation. Not bad for the son of a steel worker from Gary, Indiana. His website, by the way, is www.drdickbarnett.com. And you can learn more about what he's got going on right there. You can learn more about what I've got going on our website on 1070thefan.com. Click on shows, click on one-on-one, and the podcasts from all the episodes are there for your listening pleasure. You can always reach me by email at mark@1070thefan.com, and I'm available on Facebook and Twitter. The Twitter handle is @MarkMonteith. And of course, I'll be back next week with yet another spine tingler with an Indiana sports personality right here on 107.5 FM and 1070 The Fan.